The presentation of Mr. Sears was drawing to a close. I suggested to Fred that he's pointed us forward so beautifully that it would represent a sort of stripping of our spiritual gears to then talk about a past dispensation. And I had just about readjusted my gears for today when it was announced that I would be talking on Hinduism another 3,000 years backwards. It is Islam. And secondly, it would be outside my competence to present any kind of systematic, well-proportioned presentation on a religion so fully in the light of history and with such well-developed institutions and literature in the course of 1 hour. Therefore, what I'm going to do in less than an hour, hopefully, present a few generalizations about Islam that are directly significant to Baha'is. Now, on the basic relationship of the Baha'i faith to Islam and the all importance of study of Islam for the Baha'is, I don't think I need to say anything. We have an example set before us by Abdu'l-Bahá himself. If you go over his talks in the United States and in Europe, on so many occasions when he was asked to speak in churches, he chose to speak on Islam and on Muhammad, and he was educating the general public as well as the Baha'is. Those Baha'is who didn't pick up the hint were further reminded very unequivocally by Shoghi Effendi that the study of Islam is of particular interest and indeed indispensable for understanding of the Baha'i faith. And it is in that light, that is the relationship of the Baha'i faith to Islam, that I like to talk about Islam. Now, this relationship is to be understood in on many different planes, at least two very important ones. The first is the plane of continuity, or the unfoldment of divine revelation. The relationship of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah to that of Muhammad in this line of progressive revelation. There's a great deal that we understand, are clarified for us about the Baha'i faith when we know the background of Islam. That is, religion as the unfoldment of the divine will on this earth. The other aspect has to do with institutionalization of Islam, and with attempts of human beings, adherents of Islam, to create a community life, a polity, a social order that would approximate the ideals of that religion. And in that respect also, the further elaboration, magnification, ramifications of the world order of Baha'u'llah as related to religion of Islam are very important for us, and so that it doesn't come as a shock in the course of my remarks to you, let me say that whereas in the first case, that is a backward glance at Islam in the light of the unfoldment of progressive revelation, everything that we see is harmonious, is reasonable, is explainable. In the other respect, that is, looking back at the attempts of community of Muslims, on the large part,
to create a social order, according to the teachings of Muhammad, we find as many positive lessons as negative ones. And since the positive lessons are more or less in the domain of history, the negative ones are all important for us. That is, we have to learn where a social order of Muhammad was named, in what way it was prevented from coming into full fruition, and in what way possibility of making same mistakes may exist in our own dispensation, and particularly in this light we understand so much in way of precaution, way of warning in the writings of Baha'u'llah, of Abdul Baha, of Shoghi Effendi, in their actions also, which could be properly understood only in this light of warning us to avoid the mistakes of the previous dispensation. So I'll speak about this second aspect probably a little more than the first. It is true that of all the traditional religions, the great world religions, up to the advent of the Bab, Islam, of course, has taken place more or less under a full glare of history. It's been observed. Muslims themselves did a much better job of recording the origins of their own religion. The Holy Scripture of Islam, the Holy Quran, was taken down, in fact, in written form during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad himself, and then compiled within 30 years of his death. In all these respects, we are dealing with a major world religion about which the element of speculation, the element of guesswork and so forth is, compared to other great world religions, is at the minimum. The birth of Islam, like birth of all world religions, of course, takes place on the stage of history. The will of God enters the affairs of men, and this point of entry, therefore, is all important. Despite the effort of a number of mystics in Islam as well as in other religions to try and explain away or minimize this dimension of time, we simply cannot get away from it as human beings. So the circumstances surrounding the birth of Islam are very important for understanding of the interactions of Islam with the world of phenomena, with the reaction of human beings, in the same sense that a study of the Baha'i faith cut out of the context of its history would make only partial sense. Therefore, I'm trying to look back at the birth of Islam in the context of its history. In Arabian Peninsula, where the form of life was essentially classic representation of tribal organization, which at closer glance very often looks like tribal chaos. The notions of kinship, of honor, of pride, all the values of society in life in Arabia were directly related to the tribal state of existence in the 7th century AD in the Arabian Peninsula. And this meant, in fact, that under those rather austere, in fact, inhospitable natural conditions, where there is never enough food, and there's always a danger of overpopulation, tribal warfare, rivalries, just a war of cousins was the rule rather than the exception. And if one can generalize about a mode of existence of Arabs before the appearance of Islam, one has to say that raids and plunder were probably their primary source of economic sustenance, and all the values that were associated with this kind of existence made the appearance of a universalist ethical religion such as Islam a task verging on the impossible. Therefore, the sufferings, the tribulations, the terrible setbacks that Muhammad had to endure in the course of his ministry, his life, are to a great extent due to the strictures of life in Arabia, to the structure of tribal life in that peninsula, and specifically a form of religion that these Arabs practiced was a kind of nature worship made particular and objectified in number of idols. Since they were nomads to a great extent, there were a few towns developing in Arabia, but majority of people were still living in a nomadic condition, and since they raided and they moved a lot, their idols were also portable, so that they could carry them along and worship or propitiate these idols whenever necessary. Now, the call of one transcendent God who could not be seen, who could not be objectified, who called all these naturally fighting men. When I say naturally fighting men, that is, their experience had more or less made it their instinct, their second nature, to look at each other in a hostile atmosphere. And the teachings of unity, of equality in faith, of generosity, of sacrifice, in other words, all the great ethical values of a universalist religion, which in fact envisioned the uplifting of that society to a plane much above what was then conditioned in Arabia, and a system of values and ethics that was also considerably advanced for the more civilized societies that lived outside the Arabian Peninsula and that were to be influenced or were to come under the sway of Islam. When you look at, in other words, the birth of Islam under these hostile conditions, then you see once again, it's this another chapter in the basic points that in the Baha'i faith are fully enunciated in the name of progressive revelation, part of which implies that divine guidance is sent at times and to places where need for that divine guidance is greatest. Now, it is always one of the greatest misunderstandings surrounding Islam, particularly in the West, particularly among Christians, and this is a legacy of centuries of polemical encounter between adherents of these two religions. It's a usual objection is raised that if Islam was such an ethical religion, was to bring a realization of a brotherhood of man, of equality in faith, and all these things that I've talked about, why did it have to spread by the sword? Why did Muhammad himself have to engage in warfare in order to bring about peace? The name Islam, by the way, the name of the religion, is related to the root of peace in Arabic language. Peace that comes out of total submission of the will, of man's will to the will of God. Therefore, the words submission and peace are related in the Arabic language, and both of them have a great deal to do with the view that Muhammad presented to the world of this religion that he was bringing. Well, what's the answer to the question? Why the need for a warlike making of such a peaceful point in history, especially since, again, in the context of progressive revelation, we know that the previous dispensation of God, that of Christ, had emphasized completely the individual aspect of faith, the salvation of souls, and leaving to Caesar what belonged to him, and turning one's back almost to all questions of social and political organization. So against that background, we might ask ourselves, why did Islam have to be established in that fashion? Yes?
Was it because Muhammad was more interested in community life, and that it was the protection of a group of people that he used the sword?
Well,
instead of attacking and defending a group who were submissive to his law?
I think you're leaning in the right direction. Certainly, the intent of Muhammad was to create a community of Muslims, not just a confession of Muslims. But I'm asking the question, why did it have to be that way? After all, Christ more or less seemed to make him to be content with the creation of a new creed, a new confession, and Muhammad found it necessary to build a community in order to uphold this confession. And the reason for that is to be found in the circumstances of society in Arabia to a large extent, immediately, and looking forward to the need for a form, a foundation, an organization which could properly carry the spiritual message of Islam. To begin with, the immediate problem, as Muhammad, the Prophet of God, realized very quickly, was that under the conditions of Arabia, the establishment of creed of Islam had not a chance without the creation of a political foundation for it. Therefore, we have to look at the career of Muhammad at least in two lights. One, a messenger of God, the channel through which the revelation of God is given to man over the course of 20 odd years, and the other, they figure the same man as the creator of a state, creator of a polity, which was necessary for the safeguarding and for the proper nurturing of that revelation. And since he came at a time in history where the achievement of that political and social goal was very essential, in fact was related to, was part of the spiritual message, therefore it fell upon him to tackle the dual task simultaneously. So the creation of a community with its organization was a necessary, inseparable base for the unfoldment of the spiritual message of Islam. That creation under the conditions of Arabia could only come about in a tenacious and diplomatic and astute statesmanship. All of these qualities were abundantly present in the person of Muhammad. Now, it is in the light of comparative history, one of the great, really dazzling, to anyone who does not allow himself to look at things from the point of view of faith, one of the miracles of history, the political accomplishment of Muhammad. That is, in a lifetime, he succeeded in unifying the whole Arabian Peninsula, and he succeeded in creating, or rather inspiring, these Arabs who, up until a decade or so before, were animated primarily by their own tribal vanity and selfish interests, in inspiring them with a love of God, a religious zeal in the best sense of the word, that enabled them to carry on this message almost to all the corners of the, at least half of the civilized world of that time, in the course of a century following Muhammad himself. But now here comes the number of parallels that I'd like to draw, and sort of these backward glances from the near perfect edifice of the world order of Baha'u'llah to the somewhat embryonic beginnings that are evident in the social order of Muhammad. While he was creating this great organism, he inspired his followers to such an extent with the power of his own example that apparently the considerations of future, no matter how he would want to bring these considerations to the attention of his followers, somehow did not register in any realistic and practical way with these followers. In the Quran, there are laws governing personal status of Muslims. There are laws governing social relations of Muslims. But there is no clear-cut charter for a social and political order that was to be established and to be maintained in the sense that we have in the world order of Baha'u'llah and in its organizational form, the administrative order in the faith. Therefore, the majority of his closest companions and dearest friends and helpers, a notion of what would happen after the death of Muhammad apparently was one that they did not face, or at least if they faced it, they put it out of their mind. Now, it so happened that Muhammad himself was not altogether careless of the future. In fact, on several occasions, he pointed to his cousin and son-in-law and the first man to believe in him, Ali, as one who would carry on as a successor. But the conditions of this designation, the terms in which he made this designation, and the understanding of it by majority of the Muslims apparently, were far from clear-cut, with the result that when Muhammad died, there was a crisis of first magnitude facing the community of Muslims. A crisis not only for the future of Islam, but for the present of it. Because great as the accomplishment of Muhammad had been in unifying the various rival tribes of Arabia, it was to a great extent an individual feat of eliciting loyalty and allegiance to his cause as personified by himself, and at best it was a very precarious and touchy balance. And good many of the very close friends and companions of Muhammad at that moment of crisis, the death of Muhammad, frankly had uppermost in their minds a immediate exigent problems of what's going to happen to such and such a tribe who lives next door to such and such a tribe that up until 5 years ago were at each other's throats, and now that Muhammad is gone may fall at each other's throats again, and may fall not tomorrow but this afternoon. Muhammad died somewhere in midday, and the gathering of these companions to take care of this crisis was on that same afternoon. And while Ali, the son-in-law and the cousin and the man most touched personally by the passing of Muhammad, was involved in all the preparations for the burial of the Prophet, in other words, was taking care of that personal problem, a number of other close companions of Muhammad, such as Abu Bakr, Omar, others gathered together and deliberated for hours and improvised. Improvised, and in terms of, I'd say, immediate politics of the day, one has to say improvised rather brilliantly, to designate one of them as the caliph, meaning the successor, one who stands in place of Muhammad, not necessarily to perform the functions of Muhammad, but who would stand there and who would be the focus of the same kind of allegiance, the same kind of authority and respect that was given Muhammad. And in Arabian society, where patriarchal order was very much the order of the day, white beard and hair was a considerable asset, they chose the oldest one of the associates of Muhammad, Abu Bakr, who had the whitest and the longest beard. And thus, series of perhaps well-intentioned, and in some cases maybe not, series of improvisations at creation of a social and political order for Islam began virtually the day of the passing of the Prophet Muhammad himself. and in course of time, this led to creation of institutions such as the Caliphate and Sultanates here and there, which in one way or another managed to depart farther and farther from the original precepts, that is, the social and political precepts of Islam. Practicalities of holding power, the needs of consolidation of this power and so on, so forth and so on, led all these subsequent improvisers on the theme of a Muslim social and political order to fail to a greater or lesser degree in bringing about anything resembling that ideal which is embodied in the Quran and in the example and life of Muhammad. Those few Muslims who from the very start felt that in bypassing Ali or in ignoring the special designation that Muhammad had made of his son-in-law, that something unfair or unjust was done, even they perhaps did not have a full awareness of or consciousness the implication of what they were saying. They were probably reacting in the manner of the injured party, where you think that in a distribution of the estate of a man who was deceased, the rights of one person have been perhaps overlooked or slighted. But among them were also some who perceived perhaps the proper elaboration and institutionalization of this social and political order of Islam would have to evolve around that line of succession established by Muhammad in the person of Ali and in the family of Ali. And so they call themselves the party of Ali, word for party in ancient Arabic is Shia. So the Shia of Ali, in a sense, means those who are on the side of Ali, or the party, the supporters, the partisans of Ali. As I said, there was by no means a fully developed, a far-reaching notion of what Shiism means, or what partisanship of Ali would bring about. And since this view in the course of history tended to be always a view of a minority who protested the aberrations and the abuses and usurpations of those who were controlling the caliphate, invariably a kind of internal stunting and maiming took place within the community of Shi'is at all times. When you go through life always reacting against something, you never have a chance of developing anything positively, you're not likely to conceive of any really integrated, systematic, rational system as well. So this whole notion of legitimacy, of succession, of what constitutes proper development of Islam, as you see, all of them became to a great extent rather moot and academic questions from the very beginning. And yet, we have the development of a civilization, the coming about of a golden age, the actual, say, viability of the notion or the idea of faith in God according to the teachings of Muhammad, that has lasted all these 1300 centuries, despite this tragic and irreversible stunting that took place in the social and political order of Islam. How do we explain this? The power of God released through His word in human society, up until now anyway, probably has given no demonstration of its dynamism, its potency, its really germinal force, as it has in the case of the civilization of Islam, I'm trying to say, in fact, is that spiritual content of the teachings of Muhammad, which reached the hearts and which affected the world view of these Muslims and their views of themselves and their views of their fellow human beings and their relations to society, that spiritually satisfying and fulfilling message was almost single-handed responsible for the achievement of Islam, despite the fact that on the social and political level, so little that was right was done by the Muslims. Now, we know that spirituality, without certain forms, without certain guidelines that can more or less influence and change a mode of life, not only individual but social communal life of people, is a very difficult thing. Even in Christianity, where there was so little emphasis on the organization, it was necessary, that is, in the teachings of Christ Himself, it was necessary for the disciples to create a church and to maintain within this church a kind of vigilance for the protection of the message of Christ in order to give it a chance to spread as far as it could. In the case of Islam, this cup, this chalice, which held the spiritual fluid or liquid of faith, happened to be the law which generations of brilliant Muslim jurists extracted from the Quran and from the practices and examples set by the person of Muhammad himself. A law that became, in fact, the backbone of the community of Islam anywhere and everywhere in the world. And it is essentially the relationship of the Muslim to this law that is the heart of his identity as a Muslim. That is, if you ask any Muslim anywhere in the world, what makes you a Muslim, his answer is bound to be because he upholds the Muslim law. I'm perhaps now talking somewhat in a static sense, because we do know that part of the process of disintegration of the old order of the world that is in the Muslim parts of the formerly Muslim, let's call it, Muslim parts of the world, one of the most evident and flagrant signs of disintegration is that disintegration of law itself. But I'm trying to draw your attention to what enabled Muslim communities to maintain a communal existence and to practice Islam was this chalice, this or channel, if you like, of law, and within it that spiritual fulfilling content of a religion of Muhammad. Islamic society, especially widespread as it is geographically and lasted as long as it has, is far from a homogeneous society. Yet, there have been times in history when one could speak of one community, where one could travel probably from the shores of the Atlantic to the shores of the Pacific and feel at home. To the extent that this real accomplishment was lasted, it was due to that balance that existed between the law of Islam as the frame encompassing the life of the community and that spirit of faith animating the motivations and behavior of the individuals. A few words about the nature of this spirit. I think that one can generalize about the experience of the holy, if you like to talk about it in that way, or the consciousness of the element of faith in various religions. In that sense, I can only characterize a characteristic of Islam to being an imminence, a close presence of consciousness of God in virtually every aspect of human existence. A true Muslim lives in the name of God. He undertakes even the most trivial actions of his daily routine with a mention of the name of God. And it is the extent that that passage in the Quran, where God speaking through Muhammad says, "I am closer to you than the vein on your in your neck." The imagery of the Quran is beautiful and sometimes terribly direct and very physical. And think of the, or imagine, sense rather, the throbbing of that life vein in your neck and that statement in the Quran, "Inni aghrabu ilaykum min habl al-warid," I am closer to you than the vein in your neck. It is this living in proximity, such close awareness of presence of God, which really is the distinguishing feature of the Muslim faith, which in itself inspires tremendous, say, God consciousness, which has given birth in Islamic culture to philosophical and cultural movements which will remain as a glory of Islam and will enrich the annals of human civilization forever, all animated by this consciousness. But the close relationship between the upholding of the law and the awareness of this spirit is a characteristic of Islam also, and is a characteristic of true Islam. And we find also that, like human beings everywhere, the achievement of this balance, the maintenance of this equilibrium, was not an easy thing. That because of temperament or because of conditions, a number of factors, there appear in history of Islam legalistic authorities who like to close the book on all kinds of intellectual activity, on all kinds of thought, and say, never mind, the letter of the law is sufficient. Close everything else. Close the doors of consultation, of consensus in the community. We don't have to look beyond the letter of the law. And on the other extreme, from this kind of legalistic orthodoxy, the rather shameful aberrations of so-called radical Sufis or mystics, who felt that some kind of a direct line to God, mystical communion with Him, exonerated them or made them exempt, rather, from responsibility to any law, and they could do whatever they pleased as long as deep down in their heart they knew that they had the right connection, and each in their own way, the anarchic mystic as well as the orthodox legalist did their best to stifle the true spirit of Islam and to create a rather static and decadent community. Only it was left for few universal geniuses, like the poet Rumi, a favorite of Abdu'l-Bahá, a poet who is quoted so often in the Seven Valleys by Baha'u'llah himself. A few geniuses like that, who are, if one can really become true exemplaries of the faith of Islam, they probably were it, managed to combine the two, the upholding of the law, the needs of the community, with that soaring spirit. And you read in their writings, there's absolutely no room for rigidity. There's no room for legalism. There's no room whatsoever also for behavior which is in any way outside the pale of law of Islam. And the recognition that all the truth, all the spiritual sustenance that a Muslim could have comes through the revelation of Muhammad and through his Quran, that is very clear and very unmistakable. And it is the example of men such as Rumi, which more or less open up a beautiful vistas of the future for us as we contemplate the golden age of the Baha'i era and the creation of a Baha'i culture. and it is the behavior of the Muslim clergy. It is also the behavior of the Muslim Sufis that raise all danger signs and warn us of things to avoid. You know, Muhammad made absolutely no provision for a clergy. There is no mention of a clerical order in the Quran. Yet they came about somehow because of that original stunting that took place in the social and political order of Islam. You look at it and you turn to the Iran. There is by our best guide to Islam. Whatever I or anyone will have to say on the religion of Islam and its relation with the Baha'i faith, in the nature of very incoherent murmurings compared to the most systematic upholding of true Islam and the preparation for acceptance of a new order of Baha'u'llah himself that he has given us in that book. Therefore, it's our guide really for study of Islam in the light of continuous unfoldment of progressive revelation, but it also is full of warnings against the abuses of the clergy, the things that went wrong in Islam. And in the same vein, I might draw your attention to those passages in The Promised Days Come of Shoghi Effendi, where the negative lessons that Baha'is have to learn from the history of Islam gone astray are beautifully and powerfully and clearly delineated. I think that I should stop now. I know there are quite a lot of questions, and I'd much rather answer questions. Jim?
One of the questions you brought up about the Shia.
Yeah.
Now, what role did the Sunnis play at the death of Muhammad?
Those who followed the original improvisers came to be known as the Sunni. That is, the whole institution of the caliphate and everything that went on, more or less, from a historical point of view, among the majority of the Muslims, is what we call the Sunni Islam. Yes. The Muslim religion. Excuse me for interrupting you. You know, no, it's a simple matter of really language and grammar. Islam is the noun, Muslim is the adjective formed from that noun. So, the Islamic religion or religion of Muslim, as referring to as Islam by itself, is almost as odd to my ears as saying, let's talk Baha'i.
Yes. The fastest growing one in the world, I imagine, among Africans. Is this true? And if so,
well, this is a modern phenomenon. I think the reason to a great extent are reaction to European imperialism. Majority of these Africans, particularly in West and Central Africa, that find Islam so attractive, at least the variety of Islam that is presented to them, do so because they don't have any experience of Muslim exploitation. They don't have any experience of kind of racial prejudice practiced on them by Muslims. And let's face it, compared to the rather hypocritical way that majority of Christian missionaries have to
act in Africa. After all, look at the Union of South Africa. It's a church state almost. It's a Dutch Reformed Church. You know, compared to that, the message of Islam is a pretty simple, pure, and egalitarian message. What these Africans will have to wait and find out is that, beautiful as it is spiritually, it's not going to solve the problems of modern man in this century, and for that they have to tend to this.
You know, yes. No. Yes. Yes.
How do you explain the fact that there's so little evidence of the brotherhood among the tribes of Arabia, you know, on the afternoon of the death of Muhammad?
The task of political adhesion before the cement has really hardened. If you subject it to strain and stress, it's likely to come apart. And essentially, that's what Omar and Abu Bakr were afraid of. Maybe they were oversensitive on the subject, but the way they looked at it, they couldn't take any chances. Yes.
I mean, I think that perhaps it would be good here to offer some comparative data with the take of the early Christianity on the afternoon of the crucifixion for the next 300 years.
Yeah.
Because this way it may sound as if, even though I know that you do not intend the question this way, it may sound to some people as why in Islam was there a lack of brotherhood?
Yes, because
if this happens
also
elsewhere, maybe I
didn't
like to
double. Well, why don't you continue? Christianity is not my department. So that's what I said anyway.
This is
a
good evening.
I'm sorry.
I would like to
ask
you,
you all sharing it.
I think that you have mentioned that the Christian
Don't be bashful. I thought I'd get a rise out of you somehow. Now. But while you're deciding, there's a question back there.
See, in the Lahan world, have a very good sense.
Precisely. Precisely. Yes, this is so. I say the things that we have to guard against, things that we have to be alert, and things that we have to be thankful for.
The tremendous amount of not only there is really a complete charter for world order, but even in detail, in matters of, you might call them tactical approaches to the problem, so many beautiful safeguards are written into this charter by Baha'u'llah himself, by Abdul Baha. And I wonder how many of you pondered that passage. There's a short passage in Prayer and Meditation. I wish I remembered it verbatim. I remember it in the original Persian, but not in English. Where Baha'u'llah is offering a prayer on behalf of the Baha'i community that, please God, we may be safeguarded or against the superstition, against the aberrations that occurred in previous dispensations. It is key, really, that Baha'u'llah offers on behalf of Baha'u'llah. And when you have Baha'u'llah praying for you, like that, I think that that would be of strength to the Iraq. Yes.
What's the basic foundation of Islam was based on peace? Why did they have to fight all the neighboring countries to bring the message to the country, the people?
Well, this is really, beginning my talk with this question, I would try and answer it, but apparently I didn't do a good job.
The
question is, why did Muhammad have to fight and spread Islam by war? Well, to begin with, in the conditions of Arabia, had Muhammad not defended the community of Islam, it would have surely perished. This, according to testimony of Muhammad himself, it's not my historical interpretation of events. Therefore, I mean, this is what I had in mind when I said that the task of creation of unity beyond the social order was part and parcel of the religious dispensation of Muhammad. Now, the momentum gained from this accomplishment next door to some pretty decadent, doddering societies that were full of social injustice and really ripe for a message like this, by just natural action and reaction, could produce the results that it did. From the point of view of the surface of history, it looks like a very strange thing that a bunch of Arabs all of a sudden knock off the two superpowers of the time, the Byzantine and the Persian Empire, almost simultaneously. Well, you look closer and you find out that that Persian Empire was one rotten mess, and that the Byzantine part of the world that Islam overran on the day, practically, on the eve of the advent of Islam, was busy in sectarian squabbles, knocking over the heads and arms. Was it two fingers or one finger, the whole dunking or sprinkling, and actually the nature of the problems at that time was slightly different. Whether the Trinity is a substance or an idea and so forth and so on. But this was the situation. And natural dynamics of growth of Islam and momentum of this accomplishment in Arabia just took it beyond these borders and managed to really, it blew like a fresh breath of air in all these societies. Yes?
Muhammad is important to that they come to fight Islam.
Well, the initial... The initial rounds of battles were defensive. Yes, right.
It seems to me that the comparison is wrong too, because in a sense we should really compare Islam to Judaism and not to Christianity, because the overall conditions were more like that. Just as the Jews had to preserve the ideal of monotheism by constant battles with the Philistines, with all those surrounded them, so Muhammad was in the same state of development. He had to preserve the idea of monotheism against the past that lived around him. Where Christianity came a level higher, came on the heels of Judaism and on top of the accomplishments of Judaism. Islam had nothing like that to build on.
Yes, I should look on this side of
it.
No, he fought.
Yes,
he fought, and he was a very good general at that as well. Yes.
The general said, "The followers of Moses were threatened by the Philistines. Followers of Muhammad were threatened by the other Arabs in the area.
Yes.
The followers of Christ were never threatened
Well, let's face it, there weren't that many followers.
They only wanted to fight. Makeup wanted more. And if Timothy could have had their way, they wouldn't have been very nice.
Well, just you know, I tried to, in very large strokes, put some generalizations before you here. But this task of political unification, anti-Islamization of all of Arabian Peninsula was far from an easy task. In fact, in the lifetime of Muhammad, there were numbers of recalcitrant tribes, you know, that came in more or less for political reasons. They figured out that it was their best interest to say, okay, we are Muslims too. And then as soon as those conditions that they had calculated according to their own selfish interest changed slightly, they pulled out. And they presented quite a threat to the Muslim community and had to be fought again and reconquered. So that these facts are also to be taken into consideration when you realize the nature of crisis facing the followers of the Prophet Muhammad. They have full, living, very recent recollection of all this sort of apostasy from a religious point of view, treachery and defection from a political point of view.
What you said 5 years before, that they were fighting each other.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I think, you know, as an historian, I feel uncomfortable. I think that we took an
impulse. Here's another person who's feeling uncomfortable.
It's not enough to say that Christianity came at a higher point of development. In the first place, one must separate the teaching of Jesus Christ from what Christianity was. Because Christianity is not only a red letter part of the Bible, but it is also the 2,000 years of the understanding of Christianity by those who profess to be Christians. Yet Islam is not only what it says in the Quran. As Amin said, it has nothing to say about the flesh. Yes, there were imams and occasions about them. Now, to Christianity, war was not abolished. There was never a time in Christianity until perhaps in the 17th or 18th century, or a few minor sects, even in the 18th century, minor sects like the Quakers, for example, where you could hear the old war. Essentially, Christianity always accepted war, and Christianity essentially accepted conversion by force. In fact, the number of people who were converted to Christianity through the exercise of military force was no smaller than the number of people who were converted to Islam. For instance, the conversion of the Saxons by Charlemagne, the massacre, the conversion of Russia to Christianity, all were carried out by government with military force. Therefore, I don't see this distinction. Christianity is peaceful, kindly religion turned to the other cheek, Islam a militant, vicious, in fact, if we are to judge the tree by its fruit, that Christianity and Islam come from the same goal. Now, the distinction that I think is that the teachings of Jesus were addressed to the individual. And when Muhammad talked to the individual, he also talked about mercy, kindness, submission, and God.
Dave, you had a question? No? All right. Beth, how long do you want us to go on?
Another 5 minutes.
All right. Dean?
A secular religious
thing.
Pardon?
Yes?
A secular religious thing.
Well, if you want to talk that way, then secular has no meaning in Islam. There's nothing secular. It is a community of God-fearing men. Everything, every action from the moment you wake up in the morning to the time that you go to sleep is God-oriented, and there's nothing secular. And Imam certainly is, in the Shi'i tradition, is the personification of
totality of authority and sovereignty.
I think that sort of answers my question, in that I was wondering what relevance the fact that Baha'u'llah's return of the 12th Imam is.
Baha'u'llah is not the return of the 12th Imam.
Okay.
The Bab's 23.
The Bab is considered the return of the 12th Imam. Yeah. What relevance that is, since the Imam is not a prophet, but a leader.
That relevance is in the line of the continuity of unfoldment of religious prophecy, expectations of Muslims, part of it, are expressed in terms of the return of the 12th Imam. And therefore, the initiation, unfoldment of the next stage to those Muslims who have that view has to be in the form of the return of 12th Imam. For those people, the Bab is the 12th Imam. You look at religious history, really, I'm just concentrating on the figure of the Bab. How many things, how many people he is? It would make no sense whatsoever to speak to a Christian in Europe about the Bab and the 12th Imam. Oh, you know that the 12th Imam is from Norway, that's what good for him. Yes, there's something very relevant to that European Christian about the coming of the Bab. And it's not Bab qua 12th Imam, but Bab as a bringer of a new dispensation preparing the way for the universal manifestation of Baha'u'llah.
If the Shi'i movement, so, in Islam, it accepts. I
mean, it's not right. The 12 movement, just to make it more the 12 no, there are a variety of things. Okay? Is that actually the
question? What is it? I'd like to ask, would you compare, for example, the Sunnis as one of the follower of the covenant breakers? So
I will not make
would say it was a bit from the beginning because the majority of them
I know that sometimes some of us Baha'is would like to sort of make absolute rigid black and white things of everything, you know, and forcing them. This is a historical fallacy, a consciousness of the way that the Baha'i faith is unfolding to us certainly has comparative and parallel implications for religions of the past. But to try and make it so rigid and to say, well, now Umar is the Azal of the Muslim perspective is a total injustice and ahistorical, completely unhistorical. So I wouldn't go along with that at all.
Yes.
Is
Omar aware of Muhammad's choice
in Mali? Well, it's a good question. It depends. You realize our past as Baha'i, and maybe as Baha'i historian, in answering that question is not as personal. The question is, was Omar aware of the fact that Muhammad had designated Ali as his successor? To begin with, four reasons which are known to Muhammad and God, he didn't make that designation of succession, and he didn't notarize it, and he didn't make it in a very loud and incontrovertible fashion. He, in fact, on that occasion of a religious festival, raised Ali to the platform and he addressed the populace. He said, I'm here, it's Ali, who is my Ali. Muhammad was given to poetic kind of phrase, you know, he likes rhyming things. Ali is one of those Arabic words that has connotations ranging from master, guardian, friend, slave, successor, all of these things. ramped up in the emotional Valley. I had an Arabic teacher once who tell me that every Arabic word has at least four different meanings. You look it up in the dictionary. Meaning A, meaning B, which is the opposite of meaning A. meaning C, which has something to do with camel. And meaning D, which is something of C.
Way to pass. So, it's all good.